Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We begin our program with a study from Ohio State University, and it's about avocados. Eating an avocado assists vitamin A absorption. Yes, why? Because the avocado is rich in lipids, those are fats, and it also helps with beta carotene and absorption into the body. It makes it more bioavailable. Remember, eating something in and of itself is healthy, that's good. But then you have to have right digestion. You have to fully masticate, chew your food. You have to insalivate it. And all that creates what is called bolus. That goes down into the stomach through the cardiac sphincter muscle. And then all of the different hydrochloric acid and other elements come in, lipase, and they break it down. And they break it down almost to like a soup consistency. And then it goes through the pyloric sphincter into the duodenum, where it's deacidified. Then it goes through your intestines. And that's where it's absorbed. So eating fast, chewing improperly, gulping down a liquid, like a cold liquid, like a lot of people do. They'll have a hamburger and a colon. And that's not good. That means you're eating, yes, but unhealthy food in most cases, yes, and you're absorbing the calories, but not the nutrients. So if you want maximum nutrient absorption, you're having a salad, have an avocado. And it also activates a form of vitamin A, which is the carotenoids. This is published in the Journal of Nutrition. So just imagine you want better absorption, avocado, red peppers, yellow peppers, the sweet peppers, and radishes. Maybe some sweet onion. Purple onion is very healthy, but even a Vidalia onion is good. And sprouts. And take your time eating. In fact, put your fork down. Listen to music. Do something relaxing. You enhance absorption, better digestion, and then better elimination. Simple, non-complicated. Now also from Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center, Synergy. You need proper amounts of magnesium to effectively utilize vitamin D. So we like to think, well, you know, I heard I need vitamin D. Yes, you do. But you need a full spectrum of nutrients. And that means zinc and manganese, calcium, magnesium, vitamin K, K1, K2, K3. All of these are important. Tocotrienol, vitamin E. So a good vitamin supplement, a multiple supplement, high quality one, would be good. But in this particular case, it talks about magnesium works best with vitamin D. There's a synergy between them. In fact, magnesium deficiency is nearly as common as vitamin D deficiency. Do you know that there are over 115 different metabolic activities responsible with the heart, just your heart, for magnesium? In fact, when I was doing marathons in New York City, and all around the world for that matter, a wonderful experience, I had a lot of people who were coming down with AFib, and they couldn't figure out why. They didn't drink alcohol, etc. And when we checked, there was a physiologist from Israel, Dr. Asa, A-S-A, wonderful guy. And he worked with the Natural Living Club, and I said, why? Of 115 more or less running and walking clubs in New York, why'd you select us? He said, because you're the only ones who understand nutrition and other factors. The others just go out there and they train hard, get fast, win races, but they have very short careers because they burn out. You do it differently. You compensate. Okay, so he worked with us for about 5 years, and he found that when you don't have enough magnesium, you can develop AFib or an irregular heartbeat, but by taking in adequate amounts of magnesium and L-carnitine and coenzyme Q10, you can re-regulate the heart rhythms. And indeed, we were able to do that. Magnesium is so important. It helps relax your muscles, helps women who have premenstrual syndrome. If you take magnesium with vitamin B6, it can frequently knock out the pain. So just make sure you're getting magnesium and vitamin D together. They're synergistic. And this was published in the American Journal of clinical nutrition. By the way, magnesium, calcium, potassium, they're all important. It doesn't hurt to spend a little time with a qualified nutritionist to find out what your needs are and get a blood chemistry. It shows you what you're deficient in. Also, I've been very concerned about how people become toxic even when they're not aware of doing something that would inherently be dangerous to them, like having a meal where you put it into either an aluminum tray or plastic tray and microwave it, because that heat creates free radical damage to the food, but it also allows the aluminum and the, just like boiling something with aluminum, it leaches out into the water, and so does the plastic. But according to Oregon State University, common chemicals may act together to increase our cancer risk. Common environmental chemicals, assumed to be safe at low doses, may act separately or together to disrupt human tissue in ways that eventually lead to cancer. They looked at 200 scientists from 28 countries, including Oregon State University, and they just took a look and said, wow, there is definitely an association between 85 common chemicals, not considered to be carcinogenic, but when you take them together, they are. That's a negative synergy. Now, the researchers reviewed the action of these chemicals against a long list of mechanisms that are important for cancer development. And drawing on hundreds of laboratory studies, large databases of cancer information, and models that predict cancer development, they compared the chemical biological activity patterns in 11 known cancer hallmarks, meaning distinctive, like biphenyl A, BPA, used in plastic foods and beverage containers. You have broad spectrum insecticides, and they use around lawns, like Roundup. Shouldn't use these. And also, stay away from antibacterial soaps that you see in public places, because those have chemicals in them that can cause cancer. So when you're buying things, like, let's say you want to spray for aphids or other insects that may be damaging your flowers, lawn, there are plenty of organic ones that do not have any toxic material. You can make your own. Now, I'm a certified organic farmer. I've been teaching farming since 1971 at Fertilizer Farm upstate New York, and I'll bet a lot of you watching right now and listening used to come up there on the weekends during the summer and learn everything about farming and homesteading. In any case, I would take cayenne pepper, garlic juice, apple cider vinegar, and dilute it into a gallon jug, and then I'd spray it over all the vegetables and plants. Didn't have any loss of plants, even in the summertime, even when it rains, sun, and everything's thriving, and insects thrive too. So that's one simple way you can do that. But there are hundreds of these good quality, non-toxic sprays. Use those around your home. All right? And next up, if you want to reduce belly fat, and some people do, arginine, A-R-G-I-N-I-N-E, it's an amino acid. This is according to Texas A&M University. Compared to other types of fat in the human body, research shows that the fat in your midsection may increase your risk of diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. Not good to have belly fat. Interesting enough, L-arginine may be a potential solution. Why? Because according to a recent study, L-arginine supplementation helped women lose inches off their waist. A total of 20 obese women between 18 and 40 were recruited for the study. They were administered 3 grams at 3,000 milligrams of L-arginine 3 times a day, but that's a total of 9,000 milligrams of arginine a day for 12 weeks. They also received lifestyle counseling. And the women tolerated the arginine supplements well without any harmful effects. On average, waist size decreased by 2 inches, and they lost an average of 6 pounds. So, why? Arginine stimulates key genes that are needed to oxidize fat and glucose. It promotes what is called lipolysis, which is a breakdown of fat, and it supports the buildup of lean muscle tissue. Now, let's just say that you wanted arginine from vegan sources, hemp seeds, nuts, all the nuts. Those are good dietary sources. And finally, from the University of Florida, calorie restriction, meaning fasting between dinner and breakfast, no snacks, along with resveratrol, R-E-S-V-E-R-A-T-R-O-L, resveratrol, is the key to kickstarting cell health. That's correct. Now, as cells age, damaged proteins and lipids accumulate within them. Impaired cell parts can send free radicals into the body, and dysfunctional proteins and lipids may break down DNA within the cells, causing them to become toxic. Cells usually clean up their own damage through a housekeeping process called autophagy, A-U-T-O-P-H-A-G-Y. But as the body ages, and in people with certain diseases, cells' ability to do this house cleaning becomes less efficient. That means it may be harder for people to recover from cardiac events, such as heart attacks and other illnesses. University of Florida researchers have found that combining calorie restriction with resveratrol, a very important antioxidant made from red grapes, helps cells to recover from damage. Good information. So let's keep ourselves healthy and clean, and let's keep our diet fresh and organic wherever possible. That's the latest on health and healing. Don't forget, go to Gary and All YouTube for my classroom on the air every day. Now, tomorrow, our next program, I'm going to talk about how zinc helps your body in 8 unique ways from the Institute of Food Technology. But now, a break and right back. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. One of the biggest issues that we have facing us today is what's happened to the middle class, the working class? What's happened to the poor class? How many people in the, let's say, the secure quality of life, middle class, are now in the poor class? How many people cannot write you a check for $500 because it would bounce? How about 100 million? How many people couldn't write you a check for $1,000? About 100 million. What happened? What happened to our society where we didn't have to lock our doors, where we didn't have major crime, where everyone had a sense of contentment? They felt good being Americans. They felt good in their society. They felt good sharing their culture. What happened? What happened when we could walk to school? In fact, we all walked to school where I grew up, unless you lived out in the country. Something happened. I believe that Victor Davis Hanson, a professor, who on some issues I agree with, other issues I share a difference of opinion. But on this one, he nails it. And then I'm going to give my own interpretation of what's going on. It's not about nutrition today. It's about being able to live in a society where you don't have to maladapt, where we don't have to keep seeing people get wealthier and then want control over our lives. What's that about? Why does a billionaire who's never met us, doesn't know a thing about us, call us deplorable? Why? Because we're not rich, not famous, not walking red carpets, not part of the Davos elite? Why? And if you live in New York City, where I moved in 1965 and lived there right up until a year and a half ago, what happened to New York City? What happened across the country? What is happening? And why is not a single thing being done to reverse it and to bring back quality of life? I'm going to get into all that today. But first, let's hear what this gentleman has to say.
There was another idea that was very important to the origins of citizenship in the middle class. Society would not then be easily defined by rich and poor, oppressed, oppressor, exploited, exploiter, victimized, victimizer. There was no binary. And most of later Marxist philosophy, remember, or socialism, always tried to suggest that history is a story of the oppressed and the oppressor and class conflict. But constitutional government and citizenship that empowers people and turns them loose to create their own economic futures and trajectories and protects their privacy and protects their property through inheritance and laws against confiscation by the wealthy of the state, that empowers a different group. And when you have that middle different group, then you avoid those simplistic binaries. And that's why almost throughout the philosophical tradition, those on the left cannot stand the middle class. They hate the middle class. They say the middle class is corrupt, or it's materialistic, or it's decadent, or it buys too many snowmobiles, or it buys too many Winnebagos, or it doesn't know how to vote right. But what they're really getting at is the presence of a stable middle class prevents government from getting bigger and bigger and bigger, or from to serve the poor that gets bigger and bigger and bigger, or it prevents people from getting wealthier and wealthier and wealthier. And so the middle class is always attacked by both the poor and the wealthy. There's another idea that comes from the ancient world that's important to remember, that something about being in charge of your own destiny combines the mental with the physical. And by that I mean, in the pre-industrial world, most people were farmers. So they would get up in the morning and they would prune vines, or they would have to plant olive trees, or in the spring, late spring, they would cut grain or thresh it, but it was a constant physical job, but yet they were making decisions. How much manure per acre should I apply? When should I pick the olives? Should I plant more olives or more vines? It was a mental task. And to the Greeks, this combination of mental acuity and physical strength made the perfect balance. Now, we all can't be farmers today. Only 1% of the nation farms, but we have all of these tasks today. The independent trucker, think about it. He has to have endurance to get on that highway for 16, 17 hours, but yet he has to make the decisions, which job shall I take? How much does diesel fuel cost? That's a very different mentality to driving a truck, let's say, for Amazon. I'm not deprecating driving a truck for Amazon, but I'm saying it's a different activity. And the same thing holds true of the business person. If you work for a corporation, you make very important decisions, but you may not be some hours of the day stocking your shelves, or you may not jump outside on a forklift to deliver the product into your warehouse. But the independent business person is responsible for his own destiny or her destiny, and one mistake can destroy their family. They're not a cog in a corporate wheel. So what I'm suggesting to you is maybe we can't be all small farmers, or we can't be all middle-class small business people, but we need this group to be present, because without this present, you do not have these independent voices, and we don't combine the physical and the mental, and we take of people who take responsibility for themselves. Okay, so middle-class citizenship is crucial in the history of constitutional government. Unfortunately, in our generation, it's eroding, and we can see it erode in a variety of contexts. The first is the average middle-class income until 2017 was static for 10 years. For 10 years, average wages of the middle class did not rise. And while home ownership at the millennium at 2000 had reached about 65%, it was as high as it had ever been in the last 50 years, it still was not as high in the 1970s and 1960s and 1950s when it was up to nearly 70%, and now it's declining back down to 60%. Why is that important? Because the house is the modern representation of the ancient farm. It's something that a person owns. They have investments in it. They're attuned to make sure the house is kept up or their investment will be lost. If you have two houses side by side, one is one you're renting and one you're owning. The one you're renting, you're not going to worry about painting it. You're not going to worry about fixing the roof. You're not going to worry about remodeling. The one that you own are. It's an investment. And that mentality that you're not a renter, you're not a transient, you're stuck in one place and you're responsible for your community and yourself and your family and your home is very important. So in the American and Western concept in the modern age, Home ownership became the modern equivalent of the ancient farm, and yet today home ownership is on the decline. There's other measures of middle class decline, and that's per capita wealth. If you look at the average American, when the average American dies, they usually have less than $10,000 in net worth. I should say 50% of the country dies with less than $10,000 in aggregate wealth. That keeps going down in real dollars every year. Over half of Americans die with credit card debt. If you were to take an ancient analysis of that, you would say that essentially large elements of the middle class have now become serfs. They're indentured. They owe someone money that they cannot pay back, and they suffer the consequences. Their buying options are limited. Their choices on how they live are limited. Their chances at home ownership decline simply because they owe a lot of debt. Nowhere is this more dramatic than in student loans. When the federal government, out of good intentions, came into the university and said, we're going to back loans from students so that they can pay your tuition, the whole concept of moral hazard was eroded. The university suddenly said, you mean we can charge tuition higher and higher and higher, and no matter how high we go, you will continue to back a student loan that'll get bigger and bigger and bigger? And the federal government essentially said yes. And so today we have $1.7 trillion in aggregate debt of middle-class children that go to campuses, and what do they find? They find a university that has a blank check to increase and increase and increase board and room and tuition. And why? The teaching loads get smaller and smaller, the number of administrators get larger and larger, and the scope of the university changes. It becomes almost the place of the parent. Your gym may not just be a weight room, it may be a rock climbing wall. Your dorm may not be a dorm, it may be a luxurious apartment. You have a latte bar. You may not just have an administrator for the curriculum, you may have an administrator for equity, inclusion, and diversity. And so the modern university is adding cost and cost and cost onto the elemental challenge of education, and they delude the student into thinking the student is not paying for this because they're taking out a loan and the loan is guaranteed from the government. But when the student graduates, the average loan is somewhere between $30,000 and $40,000. And the interest rates are supposedly subsidized, but as interest rates fell for everybody else, student loans were set by the government, and private banks usually could charge anywhere from 4% to 6% when the actual market rate was about 2%. What am I getting at? We have an entire generation of students that are graduating, often with therapeutic degrees, and are not able to find jobs that would allow them to pay off this enormous debt. If we came from Mars and we looked at this situation, we would just simply say you have tens of thousands of serfs or indentured servants. If they're not beholden to their credit cards, they're beholden to the federal government and the universities. And it has an effect on the freedom and the viability of the middle class, because there's two or three indices throughout history, especially modern history, that tell us that the middle class is very viable. The first is the age of marriage. When a person reaches his teens and he has a farm, or he inherits it, or he builds it, or he acquires something, then he has confidence, he and she, to get married. Yet the average age of Americans at marriage has gone from about 21 to 29 or 30. The second indices is when you are confident that you're economically viable and you're independent and you can manage your debt and you do not owe 50% of all your debt on a mortgage, then you can have children. And if you have children, this is very controversial, of course, because we're not deprecating people who choose not to have them or can't have them, but investment in something other than yourself, an investment in your country, with the idea that when you die, your values, the effort you put into your property, that's going to go to somebody else to have another chance to perpetuate the American idea is very essential. And yet, the age that people are having children, women are bearing children at an average age somewhere between 27 and 29 from 23, 24 a few years ago. And about a third of marriages don't occur to after a child is born. So we've radically redefined childbearing and the age of marriage. There's a third element to this dismal picture, and that is the age of home ownership. That has been delayed substantially. Whereas in the 1950s, people were typically getting married at 21 or 22, having a child 23, 24, buying a house 25, 26. Now home ownership is gone down, as I said, to about 60% of the population, and that's been delayed to mid or late 30s. Think of all of this. Young people coming of age, credit card debt, enormous mortgage debt if they choose to buy a house, marrying later, not having children. What does that do to the nation at large? Well, first of all, it's getting older and it's shrinking. So we have gone in just 50 years from a 2.2 fertility rate to about 1.9. You need about 2.1 to replace yourself. I think all of us everywhere in America think for a second and they'll say, how many brothers and sisters did my parents have? How many brothers and sisters did my grandparents have? What age were they when they got married? What age were they when they bought a house? What age were they when they had their first children? And now look at me. Do I have as many siblings? No. Have I got married at the same age as my parents or grandparents? No. Did I have a child the same age? No. It's again what Alexis de Tocqueville said is prolonged adolescence. And that is, a person comes out of their teenage years, but they have the same mentality that they're dependent and they're not going to grow up and leave the embryo of their family. In other words, in modern parlance, they're living in their basement till their 30s. And you can really see the government's reaction to this. The government today is not necessarily an advocate of citizenship. Reflect a minute on the Obama administration's advertising campaigns to further the expansion of the federal government. They had a commercial called, we call it Pajama Boy, and they were trying to sell Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. And in it, they picked a young man about 24, 23, and they put him in pajamas. The message is, I'm not at work. I may be a man, but I'm wearing child's pajamas. I don't drink coffee. I drink hot chocolate. I don't have to worry about things. I don't have to grow up. And when I worry about, if I were to worry about health care, it's given to me from the government. That was not an isolated case. They also ran another commercial, they being the Obama administration, called The Life of Julia. You may remember it. And it said, let us take us through the life of a young woman. When she's born, free natal care. And then Head Start, free preschooling. And then free counseling. As she goes through education, there's all of these free nutritional programs. There's all of these free legal programs. There's all of these free enhancement programs. When she reaches an age where she wants to go to college, the student loan program kicks in. And there's all of these scholarships guaranteed by the federal government. When she leaves, Julia decides that she wants to have a child. We don't use the word anymore, out of wedlock. She has a child, and guess what? The federal government comes in with nutritional aid and daycare aid and subsidizes Julia's decision to have one child without being married. The message of these two commercials were then, don't worry about prolonged adolescence. Don't worry about growing up and being an independent, self-supporting middle-class citizen that takes it upon himself to vote and make laws. Relax. Your economic needs, your cultural needs, your political needs, they'll all be taken care of by us, the federal government, and you'll have a wonderful life without any stress. Exactly the opposite message of what the Greeks told us was the key to citizenship.
Now, I'm interested in your feedback. I'd like to hear what you have to say, because I'll bet a lot of people, in fact, I know a lot of people in this audience are decent, good, good-hearted, middle-class, working-class people. And a lot of you now are slipping into poor class. Just a quick little thing. I don't virtue signal, and I never talk about my own achievements unless there's some specific lesson to be learned. But here's something that I wasn't aware of. But about 3 years ago, I would give people food free at the end of the day at my health food store. And I've done that since it was open. I did that starting in 1967. So I've helped in my own little way. I've helped feed maybe 100, 150 people a day. But what was unique this time is I had just come from a movie with some friends, and we take a long walk up Broadway to the store. And there was a issue that I saw a person that I used to see all the time. But I hadn't seen this person in a long time in there, probably a year. And they seemed a little embarrassed. And I said, "How's everything going?" "Not as well as I'd like, but I have to accept it." "What do you mean?" "Well, in 2008, my son suggested that we put our retirement funds in a particular area. And I am at Columbia University. At that time I worked, now I'm retired. And we lost it all in 2008. But then it got worse, and things went up in price, and I literally had no cash, and I had no income. So that was a big problem. And so I come in here at night, and I hope you don't mind, to get some free food." I said, "Of course I don't mind." I thought, whoa. A professor at Columbia University found themselves into some hard time. Generally, when you're a tenured professor and you finish your career, you have plenty of money saved and to travel to enjoy your life thereafter. That's not the case now. In fact, two professors showed up at my home here unannounced, and they were broke, dead broke. And again, because of bad choices they made in helping their son, which in retrospect, they shouldn't have done. And so they were here for a year till they could get back on their feet. They had to go into a whole new career, learn a new career. So this is what I'm saying. I'm saying things that are not being shown on television, that are not being written about, how many people are suffering. And we're not talking about it. I intend to talk about it. I intend to provide some solutions to people. I'd like to hear what you have to say. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Give us a call. I'm going to take a break now and come back. We're going to deal with some issues. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. When I first came to New York in June of 1965, just out of college, The vast majority of people in New York were middle-class people. The wealthier people lived on Fifth Avenue, Park Avenue. And but later, I would see, 30 years later, when a friend of mine, close friend of mine, became a dog walker, very successful, has a whole dog walking company. And he said that when you go into some of these people's homes on Park Avenue, that were, and maybe they're in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, they're living very poor. They've sold all the things that were of any value. They've sold clothes, they've sold furniture. And he says, "Sometimes, Gary, you can't believe that the outside of a beautiful building and what it looks like on the inside." And because they no longer earn money. Those who did, maybe their husband or wife at some point, they passed on. And now they can't mortgage anything because you have to have an income in order to mortgage something. If they sell it, you know, where would they live? So there's a hidden group of people in our society who you would not know by looking just at the outside of their home that they're struggling. But when I was doing my second documentary, which will come out in about 6 months, called Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? It's a sequel to Poverty, Inc., I looked at the outside, filmed the outside of a beautiful, you know, suburban home that the same woman had lived in her whole life since she was married, right up through the passing of her husband, her children, three children going off to college. And now she lives in one room. She moved her bed downstairs because she can't afford the utility bills. And she's not incapable of exercising, doing things like that. But in opening up her cabinet, she had all these cans of fish, but they were fish for cats, not human-grade fish. And I explained, you realize this is not human-grade fish. This is for pets. She said, I know that, fully aware of that. Then we had this conversation, what it means as you go through life, and suddenly the passage you were comfortable in and you enjoyed no longer exist. Well, how many of us right now think of the passages of life that you have been in, comfortable, happy, exciting, growing, experiences, travel, whatever, relationships, and now you're alone and you feel lonely. And when you look in the mirror, you realize that at the time in life when you were in your 20s or 30s and you decided to be more adventurous and go out more, etc., go dancing, whatever it was, that today your life has shrunk and it's a desolate place. Some people, of course, try to keep themselves busy. When I was growing up, my aunts and uncles who were old and retired, they read. They all belonged to book clubs. They all had hobbies. They were all socially engaged. They kept busy. I never once heard any of them talk about being lonely. But today, loneliness exceeds anything we've ever experienced before, and it's at all ages. Important. Now, one of the things that Professor Hansen was suggesting is that the rich and the poor both are angry at the middle class. And you have to ask why. Everything you have in life, every single thing you have, is based upon a middle class person making it, creating it, growing it, or providing it for you. Your clothes, your food, the house you live in, the apartment building you go in, the government building that you work in. All of that was done by the unseen worker bees of society, the adaptive supportives, who don't want much. Just, you know, they just want a roof over their head, food on the table, clothes on their back, and their family. And now that's being taken, because today you don't find middle class working, living in Manhattan. And that's unfortunate. Yesterday, they brought out the new figures, and it's staggering. The average, not high-end, not luxurious, not three-bedroom, the average apartment in New York is close to $6,000 a month. 3 years, 4 years ago, just before COVID, it was around $1,800. Why? Well, greed is at the top of the list, profiting when you can, without thinking of the consequences. But then who can afford these? Because the apartments are being taken as quickly as they become available. And to answer that, it's relatively simple. You simply have to know the figures. I saw a little clip yesterday, insignificant in and of itself, of just a guy on the street interviewing about five young ladies from Israel. And they were all waitresses. And yet they said that two of them said our vacation for 1 week in New York will cost us $15,000. And two others said it's going to be $10,000. So the guy said, well, how can you afford a vacation in New York being a waitress at $15,000? And they said, Daddy. Yeah, they're dads. So what we have in America is we have a upper middle class, a professional class. These people still have to work. But now, here's the irony. They have to work harder and more creative than they've ever done in their career. Why? Because they're being replaced by artificial intelligence. Lawyers, physicians, diagnosticians, artists, graphic artists, writers, editors, copy editors, music producers. All of this is being taken over by artificial intelligence. And that's unfortunate. So you would think, well, shouldn't we stop for a moment and say, well, hold on a second. Right now, if you go from the George Washington Bridge and drive up the west side of the Hudson River and the east side up through Poughkeepsie and further, you'll come to about 20 more or less little cities and towns. Those are heavily populated, almost no vacancies. And so you ask people, and I did. I went up and filmed all of that. This was 2 years ago. And why do you want to live here? Now, this was younger people. This was boomers around 40 and seniors because of quality of life. Well, what is the quality of life? There's no discos, nightclubs. Some don't even, like Kingston doesn't even have a movie theater. And it's the quaintness of small town America. So on one block, you'll have 10 to 12 stores, little boutique stores, and little restaurants, but gourmet restaurants. And I saw this, and I saw the ghettos, but I also saw the renewal. And that's what people want. And we used to be able to have that in New York City, in Brooklyn, not anymore. You had, starting around 1970 and going forward, when we were in deep financial crisis, the gentrification. Well, don't be confused. Gentrification will certainly clean up a neighborhood. You won't see poverty. You'll see beautiful boutique stores, but very high rents. And only people who have that money can live in that area. You buy out the people who are poor. You don't care where they go. Just get out because we don't want you around. Now, this is kind of the arrogance that he was talking about, of how this so-called new liberal Democrats from Clinton on, they don't like the middle class. They don't like the poor. You never see them hanging around. You never see them supporting them. You never see them associating with it. No, they want rich. They want famous. They want celebrities. And hence, they all move to the places out in the Hamptons and to other places around the United States, around the world, where only their class can exist. And you think, well, that's very selfish, isn't it? Yes, it is, considering these people are functionally useless. They do nothing on their own, yet everything in their life was made by someone that they despise, the working class. Now, I know that because I lived on the Upper West Side. I lived in a very coveted building on the Upper West Side, and I know my neighbors. Everyone I knew was Democrat and liberal. Fine, not a problem. But they didn't like the poor people in Riverside Park. They wanted to go there in the morning for their jog and their $300, you know, outfit and their $500 sneakers. But they didn't want to see someone that reminded them that that was not their exclusive park. And they would tell me this. Yeah, I wait till such and such hour to jog so I just don't have to see the poor people. As if they would never be poor. So we are really much a classist society. And we don't only, who do we say? When we've got a lot of rich people supporting an election, we don't call them deplorables. No, they're to be coveted. We call the average person that's not highly political and don't have any control over the circumstances around them in the cities, we call them deplorable. That's just very inhumane, and it's wrong. But who are these people? Shouldn't you get to know them if you're going to hate them? You should, but that's not what is going on now. The middle class fell from 61% in 1971 to 50% in 1921. In 1920 and 2021, there were 38 million, that's 12%, in poverty of some sort, meaning under $27,000 earned in a year for a family of four. There was 91 in double poverty. That's 27.6% of the entire American population, meaning they're earning $55,000 for a family of four. Now, many of those are in abject poverty. Who pays the high interest rates on credit cards? They do. Who pays the payday loan and can't pay it so they roll it over so they're paying 500 to 1,000% interest? They do. And what relief do they get? None. What legislation do they get to stop predatory loans? None. In fact, whole industries have grown up making their money off other people's not having money. Now, that's not an oxymoron. That's the kind of perverse type of capitalism we have today. But mind you, if you've grown up in having all these wonderful small boutique stores, and including in Manhattan, especially Manhattan, where you would have people have been there for generations through families, and you knew everyone, everyone knew everyone, and it was just pleasant and nice. Now, all you see are box stores, banks, and drug stores, an occasional boutique store. and they go in and out of business. And there's about a 40% occupancy problem with those. But now, who, go back to my question, who's paying for all these apartments at $6,000? And you know it's going to go up from there. And that does not include Con Ed, which doubled. So you could easily be paying $6,500 to $1,000 a month without any of the other gratuities that occur by living in Manhattan. These are not the people that once were the working class that thrived in that environment and supported the 10 different, the dry cleaners and the laundromats and the, you know, the bookstores and all the different stores you'd have on every single block. So you could walk to get almost anything you needed. Movie theaters, Lincoln Center, they were all there. Now you got people that don't use almost any of that, but these are the sons and daughters of the upper middle class and wealthy class. The parents have frequently moved out of the city, and these people now are living there, but they're being subsidized. Well, where would you live if you were subsidized? And they don't seem to care about anyone but themselves, because I see no solutions being offered. Let me give you an example. Now finally, everyone, or at least most everyone, is acknowledging that our having open borders with all the sex trafficking by the tens of thousands of young girls being brought over to be trafficked in sex and fully allowed, and the fentanyl and all the people coming in, some because they simply don't have a quality of life where they're living and they want a safer, better life here, understandable. And as long as they did it legally, you have some measure of control and you can provide assistance in a meaningful and humane way. So now, for purely political and ideological reasons, we're flooded. And I warned New Yorkers about this. I said, you don't have to be a psychic to see ahead. Right now, you know, things look normal. We have crazy people on the streets, yes. We have people who know that we don't have a lot of police because the defund the police has been successful. So they'll take advantage, yes. And even if you get caught stealing, you don't go to jail for it anymore. And one guy got caught stealing 100 different times. If you're a small business person that he was talking about that made up the heart and was the number one employer in America for the last 150 years, it wasn't the Fortune 500 companies, wasn't the government, it was small businesses. So who gets creamed? The small business person. Who gets squeezed by landlords that are unmitigatingly greedy? The small business person. Who's given no break about anything? Small business person. Okay, well now a little bit of karma is coming around because landlords are now losing their buildings. Good for them, all right? Because you kick more people out of businesses. How do I know? I know very intimately because I've been a small business person since 1967. So I haven't met a nice landlord my entire career. But that's irrelevant. What's relevant is the city now no longer has the small boutique stores that it once had, no longer had safe neighborhoods, no longer had the blend of cultures and uniqueness in a neighborhood. I remember once there was a Mexican, Italian, Chinese, Spanish, and a macrobiotic restaurant all on the same block on the Upper West Side. You don't see that now because we want box stores. We want home delivery. So when did it become okay to forego all the small businesses and their livelihoods and their uniqueness of their supply of services? But we've already done that. It's past us. And now we're on the decline. Now these migrants, and I don't blame them, they have no place to go. Well, of course, they could have gone to Martha's Vineyard, and you know that is a sanctuary place, but that sanctuary lasted 24 hours, and they were all thrown off the island, taken to an army camp. So much for the hypocrisy. I'm for, you know, woke anything as long as it doesn't affect me. Okay, well, then you're a typical new Democrat hypocrite. And that's where we're at. But what does it do to help anyone? When was the last time any president of the United States de-ghettoized a city? Name me one. You can show where corporate interest and money people went in and gentrified, where you took the poor people and you got rid of them. And in that area, one, two, three, four blocks, you made everything great. But then you had to go through a ghetto to get there. Look at Windsor, Connecticut. Look at Windsor. Ontario, right across from Detroit, one has a booming middle-class community and no crime at all. The other is nothing but crime, Detroit, and yet they have gentrified areas. They're little green safe zones, but now not even those are safe. There was just a video, I don't have time today to play it, of two doctors coming out of a bar in a gentrified upscale neighborhood, and a guy came up and just nearly killed the woman, and she's a physician. She called 911, but nothing's going to happen to the person. It didn't happen to anyone. It's everywhere because the politics is so corrupt. The police commissioners are so inept. The mayors, the people who are responsible for keeping people safe, have completely abrogated to an artificial, completely moronic, and totally immature and unrealistic ideology based upon George Soros. So what have we done? We've done nothing for the poor except increase their numbers. When you've got 91 million Americans who are doubly suffer from poverty, and you've got 38 million, that's 91 and 38. Wow. And that doesn't, they're all invisible. And what about the income? The income by percentile and economic class, the top 1%, minimally, they earn $3 million a year. The top 20%, minus the 1%, $270,000. Those are your doctors, lawyers, engineers. The fourth tier is 20% is $107,000. And then the middle class is $57,000, if they're stable. And then the lower class, $23,000 a year, and then $1,900. So if you add up the three groups together, you got 52% of all adults and children have lost financial ground. That's according to Pew Research Center. So therefore, the share of aggregate income for middle class fell from 62% in 1971 to 42% today. We have manufactured poverty. And just look at the, you know, and now look at what's happening. So the mayor of New York says that there is costing them $12 billion. They're going to need more. How much will you need to take care in a humane way? The 100,000, and now expect another 100,000 to 200,000 more in the next 12 months. About $100 billion. In fact, just the migrant crisis could cost more than the entire corrupt, overblown, completely graft-ridden New York City budget. Who's supposed to pay that? Oh, the taxpayer. And how long is that going to work? How much can you squeeze? You already squeezed 12% for the state income tax. Florida has zero. Texas has zero. How much more can they afford? And what happens when there's no more places to put them? You put them in every place. You got to build new places, and that's not going to be cheap. Right now, to rejuvenate a Roosevelt Hotel or someplace else, or put cots up in a gym, that's cheap. When you build at least humane structures for people, and you're building 300,000 to 500,000 new citizens, your entire city becomes a ghetto. And then you're going to have to watch before you go from your doorman to your car and where you're going, because then you're in a banana republic, and that's where we're going, unfortunately. But it's the reality. And just look at the debt. The current gross domestic product is only $26 trillion. The BRICS nations will surpass that this year, and that's going to cause a collapse in the dollar. And the total debt to gross domestic product is 134%. The total U.S. debt has now climbed to $94 trillion. The national debt's $31 trillion. That's outrageous. That's $246,900 per taxpayer. The state debt is $1.2 trillion. The local debt is $2.3 trillion. Student debt is $1.6 trillion. The total percentage of debt, $24 trillion, is $78,000 per person. Yeah, credit card, $1.2. Social Security liability, they've used Social Security money. They've stolen it and put T-bills in its place. What happens when BRICS becomes the number one gross domestic product? There's where the money's going to go, into their mixed currency, because they're building ports and high-speed rail and manufacturing facilities. We've done nothing to bring manufacturing back to the United States with living wages. The U.S. unfunded liability, $182 trillion. Medicare liability, $35 trillion. So what are we dealing with here? We're dealing with a massive amount of debt, no way to repay it, and so acting as if it doesn't matter. And how many children are living in abject poverty? 11.5 million, or 17% of all children. And yet, why is no attention, no media, nothing focused upon their needs? Because those in politics, both Democrat and Republican, they're paid to look after the corporate interest, not your interest. Just suggesting that we have to pay attention to the middle class, or we are lost. because I don't know anything rich people can do, do you? Outside of make money. They couldn't survive very long on their own. Something to think about. If you have an issue on this, give me a call. I'd like to hear your position at 888-874-4888. Now, before we go out of here, I want to play you one clip from someone who attended our health retreat. Now, as of right now, I'm not sure that we have any space left. We have, by the way, we have a huge, wonderful group of staff who are going to be there from all across the country. It's always fun to see them. They're such professionals. But you're going to have the time of your life, either 1 or 2 weeks in September. But again, Luanne got a lot of calls yesterday, and some people had been there before, wanted to come back. A lot of people going through crisis in their life of different types, health, financial, not knowing what to do with their life at this point. So I'm going to be doing lots of workshops down there on that alone in just 3 weeks. So you can listen to this clip first. David, how are you, David?
Hey, fantastic, Gary. Thank you so much for all that you do. And why do I want to go to the retreat? Well, for one thing, to escape from all the insanity that's going on. And I basically committed to going once a year for the foreseeable future. I've been to three. This is going to be my fourth. And I'm driving 20 hours each way, so that must tell you something. But that's because it's full of drums and percussion, because I do the drum circle there for facilitate that. Just wanted to, you know, like, the reason I love going to the retreats is I've listened to you for about 12 years before I went, and I've changed some things, but as much as I try to have a lot of self-discipline, you amaze me with yours. You're just such an awesome example. Thank you for that. And your time management is just phenomenal. So I thought, you know, I want total immersion. You can learn so much from listening to you, but I wanted to be there to experience a typical day of in the life of Gary Noll. You know, what does it look like, feel like, taste like to live healthy lifestyle at the retreat center? And it's heaven on earth there. It's just incredibly beautiful. And all the people are positive chi, positive energy. So I was able to bring that stuff back home and make some changes in my kitchen and buying food consistently, just having more discipline and trying to live, you know, the best version of myself every day. Your questions at the your lectures in the evening really helped a lot, because I think a lot of us struggle with whatever inner demons that we have, emotional baggage from the past, and you really such a huge part of us, you know, looking internally to look at that stuff and say, you know, I know I should be doing this, but why aren't I doing that? You know, I know that this is bad for me. Why am I doing that? And that, to me, quantum level jump in helping me, again, more consistently do the things that I know I should be doing and feeling good about it. And just trying to bring the best self, myself, to the world, and, you know, try to help bring love and peace to the world. Thank you.
Well, David, you're drumming healing circles everybody loves. It takes them into a different place mentally, and when they finish, they're just in, like, the state of bliss. So we look forward to your drumming circles every day.
Me too.
I look forward to seeing you too. Yeah. All right, that's David. And you'll see him in the drumming circles. We do all kinds of workshops there. Call Luanne. Again, I don't know if we actually have any space left, because she said yesterday that we're almost full. But call her anyhow at 903-881-7008. That's 903-881-7008. Because we always get this kind of rush at the end. And I tell people, even if we're full, put yourself on a waiting list, because there's always people, for legitimate reasons, can't come at the last moment. And this way you'll at least be on the list. And also, hey, Sunday, big day, world premiere of the new film, Aging is Normal, but Growing Old is an Option. There's no reason, after you watch this film, very upbeat, very positive, very joyful, very, and real, This isn't make-believe. This is not someone at a lecture saying, if you do X, you know, then Y will follow. This is people who did it, and now you see them. You see them before we filmed it. Over a five-year period, you see them afterwards. And we actually, scientifically, at the methylation DNA, we proved to add years onto people's lives. This has never been done before. I mean, never. And you see all this. You'll see some stuff you won't believe is possible, but it is. And it wasn't difficult. So anyhow, it's a wonderful film, 2 hours long. It's going to start at 1 o'clock over a Zoom call. On Sunday, then there'll be talk afterwards, and I'm there to answer questions. And in our last webinar, our last premiere, which was about, what, a month ago, we had spectacular comments of people who got so much from it. And that was Manufacturing Madness. That was a very heavy film, hard-hitting, about the mental health field. This is light. You have Peter Resnick in here. You have Mitchell Rabin in here. You have the different workshop leaders in here. You see people sitting meditating. Then we ask, what are you meditating on? What are you thinking? What's changing in your mind, your life? This is one of those things that everybody will benefit from because it allows you to realize, don't stay too long in any one passage. If that passage suddenly has an expiration date, don't stay where there's an expiration date. Create a new purpose, repurpose your life. So if you want to come there, just on, you know, you click on, and for senior citizens, it's $20 and everyone else, $30. Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, or call Neil in the Vitamin Closet today or tomorrow until 8 o'clock at night at 646-926-5430, 646-926-5430. So, and I believe our bandwidth is going to be full later today, so I hope that you have a chance to get in on that. In any case, have a nice day, everyone. Look forward to sharing more on our Monday program.